A smart person learns from their mistakes. A wise person learns from others' mistakes. Welcome to the My Mistakes Podcast. We cover the lessons learned from the mistakes we've made in business so you won't do the same. I'm Chris Chantrulli. Today's guest is Danny O'Shea. It's not possible for me to tell you all of his accomplishments in this short intro, but I will tell you, by listening to this interview, you will be very impressed with his accomplishments, and there are many lessons that you can take from it for life and for business. This episode is being brought to you by Don Pablo Coffee. Specialty grade beans roasted in small batches. It's a better cup of coffee. Get yours at Amazon or at DonPabloCoffee.com. So today on the My Mistakes podcast, we have someone I met a couple weeks ago who has a great story, and I'm sure many people hearing this are familiar with his work. So Danny O'Shea, thank you for taking the time to be interviewed and share with the My Mistakes podcast. If you could just start off with introducing yourself, where you're from, and basically what is your claim to fame, where people have heard you, seen your work, and then we'll reverse engineer it from there.
I was born and raised in the Bronx in the 1970s, hard scrabble environment, lost my father at the age of 5, got into business at the age of 6, doing door-to-door selling personalized stationery, and then I moved over to light bulbs, and then chocolate bars. And I had the entrepreneurial bug, or identified it as at an early age. And I was sweeping snow in front of McDonald's for food. Again, we didn't have much. Again, my mother worked in 3 jobs, raising 3 kids. The goal was to help my mother make ends meet. She never had an expectation to send her kids out to work at an early age. We just, I think, naturally saw how hard my mother was working. And we all try to contribute, though we were very young. And when I tell that story to people, they're like, no way did you start working at 6 door to door? I'm like, no, I did. And so I enjoyed the process of meeting people, getting familiarized with what is a purchase order. This is going back to 1975. I'm 52 years of age. And from there, I enjoyed the experience of getting delivery of people's personalized stationery, delivering it to them, asking them certain questions about their family members, holidays, things of that nature, where I could fulfill orders for them, for their family members. And I realized at a very young age when I grew up that no matter what I choose to do or chose to do, I needed to continue to always stay involved in business. So if I did a traditional job, my side hustle was going to always be something where I was bringing in an extra area of income. So through the years, that brought me into multiple business ventures, not many that were known. When cable first hit New York City in the early 1990s, it came from the outlying areas of Westchester County, which had cable. I got involved in a business that people know as Hot Boxes, did nothing illegal. And what I was doing was I was purchasing the boxes from distributors. And I used those boxes, sold them to people within the areas of the city, and probably sold at the age of 18, 200,000 to 300,000 boxes, cable boxes, coming out of Nebraska. The UPS guy was convinced when he was coming to the house, he's like, what are you guys selling? I was working with my brother at the time, and we've continued that relationship to this day. And so people are clear on this, with the laws around hot boxes at the time, it was not illegal to sell them. It was illegal to hook them up. So I could sell you the box, but I couldn't hook it up for you. So I stayed within the confines of the law. I was always interested in the law. I was considering becoming a lawyer. I went to college, Hunter College in the city. And from there, I got a degree in political science. And I had always an aspiration of helping people. And I also thought my calling was going to be something with helping people. And I enjoyed the excitement of the possibilities of, you know, trying to do something different every day. And that brought me into becoming a New York City police officer from the years of 1994 until 2004. I was working in the Bronx, in Bronx Narcotics, and I was still doing side business as well, again, all of it legal. And what happened was post 9/11, I got pretty sick, a multitude of physical issues, which fortunately got resolved. 8-9 years on the job, I was able to vest out. I just couldn't physically do the job anymore. I didn't have the energy. And that brought me into, I was working with some pro athletes, doing their sports marketing for them, traditional marketing, which was offline. So I was working with them, getting sports apparel deals, sneaker deals, handling a lot of their appearances. I wasn't an agent. I was more of a manager for these pro athletes. And so what I started to notice was a lot of companies were coming to us with these e-commerce opportunities. This was probably around 99, 2000. Amazon just had started, I believe, around 95. And I said, hey, there's something to this, where they were coming to the athletes and looking to sign memorabilia. And the memorabilia game was very hot at the time. And so as the dot-com bubble burst, I noticed that the athletes were still getting paid to sign off on the memorabilia. So I made this assumption and said, hey, if it could sell in a magazine as a product, it has a good likelihood of being able to be shipped to your house, small products, X, Y, and Z. And I generalized, you know, what is the future of e-commerce? It was all very conceptualized. It was Ask Jeeves, Netscape, logging on to this thing called the World Wide Web. It was a great unknown, Chris. And ultimately, when I decided to step away from sports marketing, I did have that experience of working in that traditional marketplace. It had a lot of upsides and some downsides. And I decided, hey, you know what? I want to work for myself and see what I can do here. And as a result of that, I started to get involved in e-commerce on the sports nutrition side. A friend of mine owned a company and he was making products. And I went to his warehouse one time and I said, hey, what are you doing with those products sitting in the corner? I said, would you mind if I took those products and, you know, gave it a shot and sold it? He said, sure. And 2 weeks later, I came back. I said, can I get more products? A month later, I came back. I said, can I have more products? And so before you know it, we were outselling him. I say we, myself and my brother, were outselling that company on the internet in 2003 while they were in normal retail as a major manufacturer of supplements. And so, yeah, that was the origins of how I got involved in e-commerce.
What got you into television production and the show that I know everyone hearing this has watched or is familiar with?
I think you're referring to MTV Cribs. So working with celebrities or athletes, one athlete in particular had a very large home in the state of New Jersey. It was 25,000 square feet. He played for the New Jersey Nets, and his home was getting a lot of attention in the state of Jersey. I had received a phone call from a girl who was working at MTV. Her name was Wendy Plout, and she had contacted me and said, hey, we're working on this concept show. We're wondering if you have any access to people with large homes. And we were able to come together. She showed me the VCR tape of the concept. And when immediately I saw it, I said, wow, this is Robin Leach and Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous 2.0 version with recognizable athletes and celebrities. And I can see where this was going. So the long and the short of it was they filmed one of the original broadcasts that they still were. It was a concept, filmed it at his home. And the decision was made to broadcast that show. And again, that was MTV Cribs. And the executive producer was Nina Diaz. And so that brought me into the television side of it. But I wasn't working for MTV, but I started to develop some relationships in the TV business and the movie business as well. And, you know, quickly I was overlapping, working with the likes of NSYNC and a bunch of celebrities. My reach started extending beyond the pro sports athletes and into more mainstream celebrity. And there was a lot of upside to that, a lot of downside to it. Again, I started to feel I was more like a babysitter in some of this stuff. And that got to be, you know, a little bit wearing on myself. And I said, you know what, I think I need to change. It was at that point where I said, hey, I think I've touched on those things when I was a little kid. And I said, one day I want to do X, Y, and Z. I think I've checked off a lot of boxes here. And I still want to go out here and try something for myself. As somebody that looks at systems and processes and business, and have really had gained a lot of experience from the NYPD working for an organization of 50,000 workers and seeing how a large organization works in the logistics, the process, the protocols. And I'm just the person that doesn't really just stand on the sidelines. I tend to look at things, evaluate them, and say, hey, can I do that better? So when I was formulating my business, I did have people say, well, did you have practical business experience dealing with logistics, X, Y, and Z? And I say, no, I don't think they realize how much of a business the NYPD really was. So I was working as a cop, but I was very, very observational in terms of saying, hey, this is what I could do better. I could take that, what they're doing here, and bring that into a business. So it worked well for me during my time in the NYPD, where it was a real training ground for me in terms of, I never went to a traditional business school. I did go to grad school, but it was not strictly for business. I knew I had very organic business experience from working, like I said, from the streets on up. And again, having that experience in the NYPD has proven to be extraordinarily valuable, or did prove to be extraordinarily valuable to me over the years, because I would have never had the same perspective in terms of learning how to deal with people, personalities, and again, process and protocols.
As of today, you took that, and then what exactly is your business right now? And then I want to go back and start analyzing.
Originally started selling the supplements for this company in New Jersey, a well-known company. And then I decided to go to the marketplace and sell to the e-commerce environment, where at the time we were getting a little bit more data where we could hone in on our audience. And that was, for us, was Google AdWords, right? So we were able to say, hey, if someone is searching for a product, we were a little further along in the sales funnel process. We have a better idea of what people are looking for, because they were also aggregating a lot of data saying people are searching for this product or this category of product, X, Y, and Z. So what we started to do was work with manufacturers in the tri-state area and across the United States. And then we started to develop products working with their contract manufacturers and bringing those products to market, and then utilizing paid advertising and search engine optimization. Again, this is around 2004, 2005, and pre-social media, probably that preceded it by 5-6 years. So yeah, we were heavily involved in content marketing, SEO, and paid advertising. And so what we're able to do is broaden out, in addition to for supplements, we started to go into more condition-related products, let it be a sleep product, an anxiety product, a menopause product, a weight loss product. And then what we started to do is also move into beauty products, skincare products. And I, over the years, I had developed a few brands, a brand called Dermagevity that did relatively well. And we had another brand called New Genesis. And then today, probably the past 7-8 years, we have been working steadfastly on building out the brand called Solvederm. You can see that on solvederm.com. We have probably 20 products. So, Chris, over the years, I would tell you that in totality, we probably have brought 250 to 350 products to market under their own brands, or there'll be 2 or 3 products within a brand, or Solvederm will have a much longer or lengthier product category of 15 to 20 products. But historically, we were launching one-offs or 2 to 3 products, and then that was the end of the brand. It would run its life cycle. We'd go back out again and introduce new products to the marketplace as we were able to improve on both the manufacturing and the quality of the ingredients.
I think this will surprise a lot of people hearing it. How does it work as far as when you have a manufacturer that is making a brand product that people are familiar with, like one of the popular ones? Are the other products that are similar, I don't want to say generic products, but are there other products that are made in the same facility using the same raw ingredients that are the same product, just sold under a different name?
So what they'll have is they'll have their own stock formulas. And so what we have done, and we made a decision early on, I think it benefited us very well, which was we wanted to really put the quality of the ingredients into the product that we were making. So we were doing a contract ingredient formula. So we'd go to them, manufacturer, and say, hey, can you put in X, Y, and Z? And we were just proposing it. I don't want to make it sound like I have a deep science background. And then they would get there with their formulators, and they would create a lot of custom products for us. Now, as a result of that, we were able to stand out in the marketplace because our goal was, yes, we're going to sell the product because it's more expensive for us versus a product that is being sold by the manufacturer as their stock formula. A contract product is a little bit more expensive, but my goal has always been not to make sales, but to build customers. So the efficacy of that product is extremely important for us. So we really went in and said, hey, we could make sales, you know, pretty much, you know, at the beginning, especially with the internet, could pretty much make sales 24/7, but can we make customers? So a lot of that was tied into, obviously, to the efficacy of the product. So we didn't want to sell just commoditized products that were off the shelf that were coming from the manufacturer. So we had them do a lot of custom formulas for us rather than stock formulas.
Because of your background with data and gathering data with SEO and AdWords, what would you say is more important, having a product with superior quality or having a product that might be slightly inferior in quality, but having someone like you who has the SEO and marketing side of it mastered?
So I would say a perfect environment is having the best product and then being able to reach the masses where the consumer recognizes that this is a really good product and you're able to sell it at a price point where, you know, you're able to, you know, make money and reinvest that money back into making more product. I think that the win is always to invest in the quality of the product long term. That's why we've had products in the market for years. And why that's been important is one of the things I'm a big advocate of is making sure that, you know, you have a diversity of income, right? Income streams. So even if you're no longer focused on a particular product day to day, and it's become a little bit of an afterthought or it's become long in the tooth, it's built up a pretty significant loyal base of customers that they'll continue to buy from you. And so that's recurring income into the future. So I don't know if that answered your question, but it comes down to, for me at least, my experience, if there's a choice between making a product that is less efficacious than a product that's going to cost you more and is more efficacious, if you can tell a story around that and tell people why we're different and why our products cost more and explain the science of it, and you don't need to go in and compare yourself against a less inferior product or a competitor's product, I think that that's going to come into the minds of consumers as they do research themselves, because people have gotten more sophisticated to the internet and being able to go to YouTube, do a Google search. You know, they can go pretty much anywhere now in 2020 versus 2010, 2005. Once Facebook came in, it became more of word of mouth, right? So those people that would go on Facebook that were buying a quality product and had a quality experience, they became our brand ambassadors, even though they were our customers. They were saying, this is a really good product. Let it be a product like Flexoplex for joint health. It's been a product that's been around for a bunch of years, and we've gotten, you know, really positive feedback over the years. And really, it's been the people that have bought that product, they become our marketers within social media. And that wouldn't be the case if they didn't have a good experience with the product. They'd be up on Yelp or some other site venting, saying this product is really not that good.
Now, going back to when you were 6 years old, starting your first business and going door to door, your brother is older or younger than you?
Yeah, my brother is approximately 2 years older than me.
Okay, so he's 8, which makes more sense than I guess 4. So he's 8, you're 6, you guys are breaking into the sales world. Did you guys have the same talents and qualities working together for so long? Do you guys usually have your own roles in a business, or are you guys both good at the exact same things? How does that dynamic work, and how did it work from the start?
My brother is less concerned in terms of his focus is more on, he's always been a marketing person. He worked for companies doing traditional marketing. He worked for pharmaceutical companies before the internet. And I consider myself a marketer, but day to day, I'm more of an operational person. I'll negotiate with the manufacturers. I'll make sure that the fulfillment operation is running well, so on and so forth. So we have some complementary skills, but for the most part, we're pretty different in terms of our approach towards business. See, my brother's a marketer and loves making sales, and I'm more about long game. So I'm thinking long game, and he's thinking day-to-day sales and how to build out that brand. And I think that that matrix between the two of us has been able to yield out a positive result. But I need to emphasize this point, that we have built out a substantive team of people. And as a result of that, we've, over the years, really built out a culture of people so that now, you know, speaking to you now, you're asking me direct questions and for myself and my brother. But in reality, is the success that I've had in business has really been attributable to 90%, 95% of the people that I work with, because I've built a culture around there where we treat everyone with respect. We roll up our sleeves. Everyone's problem is a shared problem. Yes, we all have our own roles, but when, again, this goes back to my training in the police department, when the fit hits the shin, as we'd say, every problem is to be shared, and we're there for each other. And as a result of that, we've been able to realize the skill sets of other people who are offering skills that myself and my brother don't have. And so as a result of that, we've been able to build out a pretty sizable organization where people are coming in like the A-team and saying, hey, I'm a business intelligence expert. Hey, I'm a person that's, good at SEO. I'm a person that's awesome at social media. I'm a graphic designer, because you can't do it all, right? So you have to be able to see your business and say, what's the growth potential of this business? If it was myself and my brother, we probably would have, capped out and probably been burnt out. But because I've always looked at success in business tied into growth potential and scale, I've always tried to build out a team of people where everyone feels that they're as important as the next person, and they can turn to myself or anyone in the organization, and they can criticize, they can offer ideas. And it's an environment where if you don't have thick skin, then you have a personal problem. I think that it's important, especially when you're working with your workforce, even if you have to come down like a boss. I always say, mean what you say, but don't be mean when you say it. And I think that that's resonated very well, because my door is always open, my phone's always on, and whenever there's a problem, even if it's outside of my lane, so to speak, I still view your problem as being my problem, and I want to make sure that you know that I'm here to help you each and every day.
Of your businesses, and it's funny when someone has achieved a great deal of success, how they could just kind of breeze right over it, or like right through each of those things. So of the businesses that you've created, and you're a very humble guy, so I know it's not in you to brag, but how large were some of the size of those organizations? Who are some of the athletes that you are working with, like at what level? I want to establish that before I ask my follow-up question.
So on the athlete side, I was working with the likes of, let's see, in the NFL, Jason Sehorn, Wayne Corbett, in the NBA. I was working with a few of the Nets, Keith Van Horn, that's a blast from the past name, Jason Williams, New Jersey Nets, in hockey. I was fortunate enough to be around a lot of the New Jersey Devils as they were winning a lot of Stanley Cups going back in the 90s. Sheldon Surrey, Kenny Danico. So yeah. So I and then as a result of that, so that was my reach of my group. And then as a result of just being around them, I started to have certain access that was just rather extraordinary. I got to know A-Rod. I got to have meetings with Michael Jordan. So, yeah, so it, through just pure osmosis, Michael Strahan, Jesse Armstead, you know, you start to roll around in certain circles and you see that they're going to golf events and things of that nature. And they start to get, you start to get to know them and you build up a relationship with them. And before you know it, you're working with them. And sometimes they need assistance and they can call on you. They know that fortunately your reputation precedes you. And I guess I had a pretty favorable reputation. And, you know, to this day, most of these guys, I'm still, I can call them up. I'm not as friendly with them since their careers are, you know, a lot of them, most of them are over, but they're still friends to this day.
And what about musical acts or being around musicians? Who are you working with there? What were you doing with them?
I put together a rock and jock softball game in Newark, New Jersey to benefit Michael J. Fox Parkinson's Foundation. I was able to bring together NSYNC. I was able to bring in Praz, and there was a lot of names that are not as relevant today. Funkmaster Flex, just a bunch of people that were hot back in the day. And then, so we were doing a lot of, I was running a charitable foundation as well. And again, that money was really focused in on, or the focus of the foundation was towards pediatric AIDS. And then again, it moved over to the Parkinson's Action Network. So I got to know Michael J. Fox. I got to know his organization, and we were making significant contributions towards that. So I was running events, large events, which was all new to me. You know, I started getting, touching my feet into the ground of doing, you know, dealing with radio commercials and selling tickets and trying to fill up a stadium, which was, again, the Newark Bears down in Newark, New Jersey. It was owned by Rick Cerrone, former Yankee catcher.
Yep.
And we put 6,000-7,000 screaming girls into the stadium. And yeah, so that was, you know, within that side of it, Joey McIntyre from, what was it, New Kids on the Block.
Yep.
I got to know Penny Marshall very well. God rest her soul. She passed away last year, I believe. One of the most extraordinary people, really funny lady. She was from the Bronx as well. So there was a kinship there. And so, again, I looked at it and say, hey, you know, I'd have to pinch myself sometimes because I'd be like, hey, I'm a kid that came from the Bronx, the South Bronx, and I've certainly exceeded my mother's expectations. And I need to tell you this, Chris, my mother thought the world of me in terms of my potential. She said, you know, maximize your potential, do whatever's going to make you happy. But she had one rule growing up, and I understand it as I got older, working three jobs and leaving the house at 5 o'clock in the morning and coming home at 11 o'clock at night, all you really could do, right? Well, myself and my brother growing up in the neighborhood was to really get in trouble. And my mother knew that, you know, we were not sitting home doing our homework all the time. We were always coming up with these crazy ideas to just to create some level of chaos as kids. And she said, listen, if you get locked up, I'm never going to bail you out. And this may not seem like a high barometer for a mother, but my mother was a very loving woman. She passed away 3 years ago. It taught me a lesson, which was stay on the straight and narrow, honor my mother, who had to raise three kids by herself without a father. And so I still got involved in certain things that really, you know, it wasn't bad as a kid, but yeah. So my mother's thing was just never get locked up because that will totally, you know, ruin our family's reputation. And the kids I did grow up with, you know, like everyone else that grows up in these tough neighborhoods, these, especially in the Bronx in the 70s, this was not a good environment. But the kids I grew up with died, got incarcerated, or just fell to the wayside, got caught up in drugs and anything else. And, you know, some of us made it. And I always looked, I could tell you this. I lived in a second floor apartment off of Fordham Road in the Bronx. There's a church there, St. Nicholas of Tolentine. It's pretty well known. I lived two buildings down. I lived on the second floor. So I used to, in the summertime, we really couldn't go out much because at the time in 1977, Son of Sam was on his shooting rampage. So it was, to give you an idea of just the chaos there, in addition to this normal Bronx chaos at the time. I used to sit out in the second floor window with a pillow and look down at the concrete and say, you know what? I think there's more to life than this. I think I need to really work harder than the next person. And so what happened was an event happened where I got my next door neighbor was Curtis Lewa from the Guardian Angels.
Yep, yep.
And he ran a group called the Magnificent 13, and then it became the Guardian Angels as they scaled out. And he had an event where he was taking kids and their fathers to Yankee Stadium. He got, you know, an opportunity, I think, through Con Ed. It was Con Ed kids, got some tickets. So I went around to Andrews Avenue, signed my name on a sheet, and said, I'm going to be there. So I go there for roll call, probably like 6 o'clock at night, and I didn't realize you need to have a father. So they called everyone's name, and all the kids got, you know, they didn't get on the bus. They had to head over to the 4 train across Fordham Road to head down to Yankee Stadium. I was left alone. And I looked at that moment. I internalized, you know, just, I wanted to cry, but I just didn't want to cry. I said, you know what? This is not going to be easy. It's going to be me against the world. And so rather than taking it as a chip on my shoulder, I got to realize at an early age that everyone's life and when they get hit with certain things is going to be different. And so I took that at a very early age, at the age of 6, to say, I got to go out here and probably work harder than most kids that have 2 incomes coming in, X, Y, and Z, or 1 income at the time for most parents, the father working and the mother home. And I didn't use it as a negative. I used it as a real driving force to say, I'm going to go out here, I'm going to hustle, I'm going to grind, and I'm going to outwork everybody.
I went grinning from ear to ear, waiting to say, I love your story. My next question is going to be asking about a role model or what was it like without a father? And that story that you just said absolutely just choked me up. Wow, that is heart-wrenching. What was it like growing up without a father? Did you have a male role model or someone that was either a coach, a religious figure, someone that you aspired to be like or to impress?
My mother was working at 2 major churches, and she was working in the rectory. She was doing cleaning and serving the priest. And one of the schools, again, was St. Nicholas of Tolentine, which some people know. And then another school, which a lot of people know, is Carmel Hayes. She was very fortunate, as an aside, in 1978, she personally served the Pope when he came and he did his speech at Yankee Stadium. So the long and the short of it was my mother used to take me to Carmel Hayes. I used to go to school 8 to 3, like most kids. And then I would jump on the 4 train with my mother. And then I'd take my schoolwork and I'd sit in the locker room as she was setting up for the priest to do their work. And I'd do all my homework. And then I would come out and I'd wash dishes in the kitchen. And so at a very early age, I got exposure to, you know, priests and just goodness and benevolence. And so they were my role models. You know, my mother was, you know, pretty religious. I mean, we were required to go to church on Sunday. She had us in the choir. I wasn't much of a singer. I was a really good mouth. You know, I could lip sync better than But Chris, my story may seem, you know, at times up and down, and you must be, you know, it seems a little sad, I guess. But the reality is I look at it, and my father's passing was tragic. What happened with my father and was unexpected was in 1969, when I was 1 years of age, he was working down in Manhattan. He worked for a local 608 in construction, and he fell 8 stories off of a building in construction. And believe it or not, he survived the fall. And he broke every bone in his body. He was back to work 2 years later. And then we were superintendents in a building. And part of that job entailed him having to put coal into the furnace. And so at the age of 39, as a result of the accident itself, he wasn't 100%. He looked fantastic. He was working out when other people weren't working out. He'd get up every morning. He'd do hundreds of push-ups. He looked phenomenal, but obviously he had internal damage. And unfortunately, he had a massive heart attack at the age of 36 years of age, putting coal into the furnace or apartment building. And so during that period, when my father passed, myself and my sister were moving around from cousins' houses and friends' homes, and my brother was shipped off to Birmingham, England, to stay with family we had there. So for the better part of 2-3 years, we're kind of in flux as a family. And my mother was just trying to make ends meet, get us into a stable situation. We're able to get an apartment and everything seemed to work out, you know. And I look at it now and I say, hey, I wish I had my father. I only had great memories of my father. And if my father was around, I'm sure he would have elevated me to be the very best person that I could be. But I got to tell you that my father's passing, if you could say that there was any benefit to anything, it just gave me a little streak to realize that, yeah, I've got talent, but I need to outwork everyone else. Because talent by itself doesn't really mean much without the work behind it. So I've had a tremendous work ethic that I think has really been in part and parcel just reinforced by the fact that my father passed and I knew it was from that young age. From that young age, when I tell that to people, I was going door to door and they're like, how did you do it? Well, I'm 52 years of age now and I haven't had one single day off from work since the age of 6.
Wow, wow, wow. It's hard to wrap my head around all this. Having the success that you've had and being such a giving person as you are and wanting to make a difference in people's lives, why do you think it is that successful people often get a bad name or by the general public are viewed as people who are greedy or thinking about profits? I ask because of many people I've spoken to or interviewed for this podcast who are financially very well off, achieved a lot of recognition. They always make themselves so available, and everything I hear from them is how giving and how much they want to help. Where do you think there's a disconnect to the public, and why do people like you get a bad rap when they just see the success?
What people don't see behind closed doors is the work. What they see when the doors are open are maybe a nice car, a house. Maybe it seems like your life is a little bit easier or a lot easier. You just have different stressors, right? Your stressors are just different. I think that people generalize and assume, well, that kid's silver spoon, right? And so it's natural. I mean, and so I think that when things are put in front of people's faces, and you can't hide it. I mean, if you have an option between buying, I don't know, a lower brand car, let's say a Hyundai, versus a Mercedes, and you feel like, hey, you know, that's the thing that I've always wanted for 20, 30 years, and you're in a position to buy it, and you can do it, and that's your reward to yourself. It's not a bad thing, right? And the reality is, you know, it's all about intent. If you go out and you buy that Mercedes, just stick it in front of people's faces to make it seem like I'm better than you. Well, I think that's a different, you know, that can definitely rile people's emotions up and they can definitely get PO'd. But the reality is it's how you present yourself, you know, how you comport yourself. You know, I try to maintain as low profile as I can. But the reality is, as much as I try to downplay what I have or whatever, you know, certain people are always going to have opinions about you and I can't control that. And all I can do is this. At the end of the day, when I put my head on the pillow, I can say this, I pick up this question every single day, which was I the very best person that I could be today? Did I answer every phone? Did I try to help? And so I can only speak for myself. And when I know that I've tried my best, that's it. What the fruits of, or what you're seeing as the rewards of my hard work. You don't, you know, most people don't realize for the past 20 some odd years, I've been working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I've got kids and I've got, you know, and I got to balance it out. And I will coach, you know, I've coached 3-4 baseball teams at one time. And there's days I'm not sleeping, you know, and I'm trying to squeeze it all in. And then, you know, then I'll have people say to me when they don't see that you're sacrificing yourself and you're trying to like help kids and do things for people that are just maybe less fortunate, they'll say things like, it must be nice. I don't really get offended. I just go, you just don't really understand. I don't expect you to understand that I'm probably working, you know, a lot more hours than you. And I've been very fortunate to recognize at a very young age that I need to work harder. And I don't blame anyone either, because it's not like you don't have the energy to do it. A lot of people's lives become more complex as they get older. They'll get married, they'll have kids early, they'll get caught into a mortgage or expenses, and they don't have that freedom and luxury of saying, today I want to go open my business, right? So I don't judge anybody, but when I was a young kid, I made sure I had three or four sources of income coming in different directions, where, again, I think that's helped me, you know, through the years. As one thing is drying up, I have another area that I can focus on, and so on and so forth. So when I tell that to people, they're like, oh, why do you work as hard as you do? Because I always look at it and say, I've had this great moment in time, but it's never guaranteed, right? And so that's been, I guess, my level of anxiety is not to maintain the material stuff that I own. It's I don't want to waste my talent. And I don't want to get too religious here, but I know this. If, you know, there's an afterlife, which I do believe, I hope that someone says, you know what, Danny, the best thing you did was you left it all on the table every single day. Because I do believe that hard work beats talent every single day of the week.
I love that. And I wonder if there's something to be said about coming out of the Bronx, because the second or third time you've made reference to talent or wasted talent, which is the famous line from A Bronx Tale.
Bronx.
Did you instill the same work ethic in your kids, or did you see that in them naturally? Someone driven like you, how do you handle being a father and not being too hard, but finding that right balance?
That is the toughest thing that I think that, you know, you that I'm really hyper cognizant of, is you want to give your kids more than what you have. I certainly don't want to see them struggle, but I want to make sure that, you know, if they're older and I'm not able to produce or not around, hopefully I'm live a long, full life, I want my kids to be able to go out there and fish. So I make it a point every single day to sit down with them. And I don't make it seem like it's the Waltons and it's the perfect environment. My house sometimes is as crazy as the next person, especially with COVID and kids are learning from the house and the whole thing. But I still make it a point to say, when we get something, I want you to understand the sacrifices that were made to bring in this television. I want you to understand what it took to make X, Y, and Z. And then I'll sit down with my kids and I'll try to make it a point to connect with them. And I'll ask them certain questions and I'll observe them. I say, you know, what do you love to do, right? And I'll see if they're really good at it. It's another thing is I've heard people say before, follow your passion and your passion will follow you and you'll be paid forever. I don't believe that at all. I have a passion for baseball, always had. I played baseball for many, many years, never reached any high levels, right, beyond high school, but I was pretty decent. But I couldn't hit a 95-mile-an-hour curveball. But I've got a passion for baseball. But the reason why I bring that up is you really need to figure what you're great at, not what you're passionate about. Hopefully there's going to be that intertwine between what you're great at and hopefully you have a passion for it. That's the win-win. It's not the passion alone. You could be as passionate about anything, but if you don't have the skills, then it's just probably not going to work out. It's just not enough to have passion. So with my kids, I'm constantly looking at them saying, and I'm analyzing them, right? It's kind of like I debrief them. I'll sit there and say, you know, why do you like that? And you like to draw. What would you think that would, you know, convey over as you get older? I got my daughter who likes to do drawing. She's talking about getting into designing. And then I'll say, hey, here's the difficulty of being a designer. And again, I don't sugarcoat anything. I said, I tell you this not to turn you off, but just to let you know, nothing is that easy. But if you work, you know, you work hard and you've got your skill, you know, you're going to put yourself in a good position. And Chris, my main focus as a parent is this, is I don't expect my kids to do better than me. I don't need them to be, you know, make tons of money. I want to make sure that my legacy is when I'm gone from this earth, that my kids are going to say, Dad gave us everything possible that he could to put us in a position of success, and we didn't waste it. We didn't waste it. We didn't go down that direction of of, you know, whatever it is that's out there. You know, we didn't get into drugs and X, Y, and Z. So I do impart that Chaz Palminteri conversation with Lilo Brancato and with De Niro.
Yeah.
Saying, you know, the worst thing in life is wasted talent. I'm a big believer in that. And so for me, if my kids are not wasting their talent and they end up being whatever it is, I don't want to minimize any career by pointing it out, and they're happy and they're productive and they're good human beings, then I did my job.
I was at a meeting last week and someone I interviewed a couple weeks ago. My exact words were, I can't stand hearing people being passionate about something or thinking that they're going to succeed because they're very passionate. And I said, passion doesn't lead to success. There's many people that are passionate about singing who aren't good singers. I said, talent will beat passion every time. And exact same thing that you just said. So in looking back at all that you've done, would you say that you've had any mistakes or something that you had wished you had done different? And what would that be, or how would that have changed it?
You know, growing up and doing my form of business, when I got into this opportunity here of the e-commerce side of it, I can't tell you I was fully confident. And so what I did was I brought on some investors that were going to offer a hybrid. I was going to sell on the internet. They were going to sell offline. And unfortunately, they didn't really produce on the offline side of it because the money was coming in on the online side of it. And I think they just got a little complacent. And I think the biggest mistake I made at that time, and I told them it was actually a good thing. The biggest mistake I made at that time was taking on investors when with no, like I didn't have an understanding, a true understanding of what value. What complementary value, like you asked me before, you know, what complementary skill sets do you and your brother have and what is different? I didn't really do my intel and debrief them and say, hey, you know, this is the value you can bring. I just expected, because they were running successful businesses on the retail side of it, is if you're going to go and you're going to start a business, start small. Keep your overhead low. You know, you need workers, try to get remote workers, go up to Upworks, go to 99 Designs. There's a lot of freelance environments out there where with a lot of tools where, you know, you're not committed to the persons. Maybe you can build up a team of those people that you have a good working relationship with. But, you know, try to keep your business as small as possible, keep your overhead low, and then start turning a little bit of a profit, hopefully cover your nut. And then with that, reinvest back into the business. Don't buy a BMW.
I love what you're saying so much, because I heard early when you first started the interview, you mentioned about making some money and putting it back into the business. But then when you touched on after 30 years, if you wanted to buy a Mercedes because it's something you wanted to drive, I didn't want that to get lost in the message or anyone to not hear how you said early on in the interview, invest in the company. So I'm so glad you said it again right here. What I see you saying is there will come a time, it might not be when you want it to be, which is right out of the gate, but with hard work, with pursuing your talent, with being smart about it and researching and gaining your intel, then you can reward yourself, but it needs to be earned.
Delayed satisfaction, right? And putting that off, and, you know, keeping things in perspective. I look at it and say, you know, do you want to have the pressure of, let's say, a BMW payment over your head at 25? And if you're thinking about, well, how am I going to pay that because sales or whatever revenues are slow this month, then it's going to come from somewhere in terms of your focus and your energy. So now let's say what made you, you know, go out and buy that BMW is that you were creative. That creativity is going to come to a crashing halt because now you're worried about paying for your BMW. And I always say it has to come from somewhere. I'm not going to tell you, you know, if as you get older and you're comfortable and you've got multiple lines of income and you've got, you know, you paid your taxes and you understand the ups and the downs of business, And, you know, you realize, and I'm, Chris, I'm a big baseball guy. So I always call baseball, business to me is always bizball. I call it bizball. It's a long season. You're going to win. You're going to win a lot of games, no matter how good you are. And you're going to lose some games. And as long as you're taking every single day and say, okay, today, no matter how bad it is, today we're going to take this small increment of a success, like working out. You go to the gym and you get 0.5% better. You just keep on building upon that. And at a certain point, you're going to look back. And you're going to go, wow, I can't believe this was me 5 years ago. Your body's going to change. You're going to see these things. And so it's the consistency, day in, day out. You're there. You show up. You make no excuses. Something goes wrong. You got to roll up your sleeves. You know, you got to get involved in that process. And you got to continue to come after it. And you got to realize, you know, one of the things that I'm, you know, especially I'm getting a little bit older here, and I'm watching Instagram because people are sending me stuff and looking at Instagram, and I'm seeing people, entrepreneurial, you know, endeavors, and kids are walking around with cars and clothes and the whole thing. And I look at that and I say, that's not business. That's some sort of social media portrayal of business. Business is tough, right? If you go into business and say, you know, oh, I thought it was going to be this and that and the other. You could deal with so many things. You could deal with insurance issues. You can deal with lawsuits. You can deal with a worker's litigation lawsuit against you, especially in today's environment. And you need to be clear-minded. You need to go at this every single day and make sure that you're checking your business day in, day out and saying, you know, am I taking preemptive steps to make sure that my business is insulated, my workers are taken care of, X, Y, and Z. So you got to prioritize. It's not about the money. The money that you make in business, that's the outcome. That's not, you should really love the fact that you wake up every single day and you're passionate about your business and you say, I'm very fortunate to be doing something here that I love to do. I'm talented and I'm passionate at it. And I have the ability to possibly change my life and the life of the workers around me. And my kids are watching me. And that to me is, you know, that's my approach towards business, which is just to leave a positive mark for the future.
Danny, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to share your story. It's so much to take in, and I know that I'm going to continue to process just each step of the way. How can people support you, find you? What products are out there? How can people learn more about what you're doing?
You can go to iHealth Fulfillment. That's my distribution company. You'll see a bunch of products that we distribute up on that site, iHealthFulfillment.com. You can go over to Solvaderm, SolvaderM.com for beauty products. I'm also involved in virtual reality. We're doing work with pro sports teams on analytics of performance. It's pretty interesting. If you go to Rezzil, Rezzil.com. I also work, and I think I mentioned this to you because in our prior conversations, I'm an investor and on the board of a company called Cognitive Code, where we provide embedded voice technology different than Siri and these other voice technologies to the U.S. military. I know the public can't really support that, but just to give an idea of some of the stuff that I'm involved in, and that's just part and parcel of what I'm doing. And my day-to-day business, everything falls under the umbrella of Channel Mark Ventures. And yeah, so I have a bunch of other things that I'm working on. And that's another thing, I should have said this earlier, is as I get older, I'm trying to do a better job of learning how to say no versus what I'm signing up for. Because what someone told me once is people love working with you because you deliver, right? And they said, don't be offended by this. And it didn't. It really enlightened me because I said, you know what? I need to learn how to say no when some of these opportunities come up, because I naturally will see some of these opportunities and say, I know how to make this work better. Well, just because I know how to make it work better doesn't mean everyone around me in that organization is going to want to share that level of enthusiasm and improve their business around them. And then I'll end up carrying a large load, dealing with a lot of pressure and stress, and that takes a toll on my other businesses. So, yeah, as I get older, I'm trying to, I guess, minimize and try to really deal with a bunch of A players. And no disrespect against, you know, anyone else, but if I deal with A players, then everyone stays in their lane and I let them do what they need to do. And then I'm able to add value and intersect where I can. And yeah, that's where I'm different from where I was 30. When I was 30, I was just trying to figure it out. By the age of 50, I'm like, I know who's an A player.
9 more years and I will have it all figured out like you at this point. And well, Danny, well, when you hear someone as humble as yourself and as accomplished as you are, it really is inspiring to look at the big picture and see that you came from humble beginnings and you probably never would have believed that you would have gotten to this place at that point. Yet now, you're still driven at this stage of the game to be working 18-hour days. So it goes to show that you just can't let go of those talents. And as long as you're still sharp, you're clearly very ambitious. The success, I think, just comes because you truly enjoy doing what you're doing and helping others.
That's exactly right. And I should have mentioned, if anyone's interested in Harley-Davidson bikes, I have 2 Harley-Davidson dealerships in the state of New Jersey. One of them is in Lebanon, New Jersey, and one of them is in Morristown. It's called Garden State Harley-Davidson. You can patronize that place. The guy who runs that is Bobby DeFazio. He's fantastic. And so, yeah, so I'm also involved in that business as well.
Well, thank you, Danny, so much. And I look forward to talking to you again soon. And I'm so glad that we've become friends. So thank you.
Ditto. Thank you so much, Chris. This has been a pleasure.
For more info, visit getconnex.com. That's GETCONNEXX.com. Or visit us on Facebook at Connex, INC, or on Instagram at Connex_. And a special thanks to our sponsor, Don Pablo. Boulder Coffee is roasted in small batches, providing the freshest tasting coffee imaginable. Simply put, it's a better cup of coffee. Order on Amazon or at DonPabloCoffee.com.